I assigned you four articles to read that are either talks that the Dalai Lama gave in various locations, or they might be something that he wrote. So one of the books that he wrote that was really a major piece of work was called Ethics for the New Millennium, which was published in 1999. The other book that he probably did write, which was published in 2012, is Toward a True Kinship of Faiths. And I picked one chapter that I thought was the most relevant chapter of each of those. I also picked two talks that he gave that had been transcribed that I picked off of DalaiLama.com, his website. He has to have a website. He has to have a website. And there are specific reasons for my picking these things. I mean, it is kind of amusing that there is DalaiLama.com and he has a website. Actually, I'll share a story with you about technology in that part of the world that's really pretty interesting. It kind of goes along the lines of the story of sitting in the sushi restaurant in Yakima, Washington, with a Tibetan monk who was organizing resistance to Chinese oppression in outside of monasteries in eastern Tibet and was aware of Chinese troop movements. You remember that story? This is along similar lines, and it's actually quite serious. I'm saying this somewhat humorously, but the last time that I was in Dharamsala, which is the Western Himalayas, where the Dalai Lama's residence is, and therefore there's a large Tibetan community around it, there are a number of cyber cafes that had emerged at that point in time. And we tend to think of India as pretty backward and so on and so forth, but because of all of the Tibetan governmental in exile activity there and all the people from around the world who show up there, the cyber cafes are a big business. And so for the cyber cafes to work, they've got to have a connection to the internet. So you may not know this, but the upper levels of Indian technology are incredibly sophisticated. So the Indian Institute of Technology is, by some people's standards, not on a par with MIT, but better than MIT. So, I mean, the upper levels of Indian technical education are really very, very good. At any rate, the point is that some folks came in and they put fiber optic cable all over this little village in the Himalayas, where when I first started going there in the 1980s, you couldn't even find a Jeep to rent. And they connected that through a big dish to an Indian communications satellite. So at the time, I was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, on the outskirts of Santa Fe. And the fastest internet connection I could get was 64K on a modem through a phone line that was pirated to somebody else's dish because nobody would run cable out where I was. And I got to India, and I had instant communication on a fiber optic network with my students in San Francisco in real time. And in Santa Fe, I had this teeny-weeny, skinny, restricted little pipeline of 64K a second, if you can imagine how slow that is anymore. So here I am in India, and I had better technology at my disposal in 1991 than I had in Santa Fe, New Mexico. The downside of what was going on is that about 4 or 5 years ago, the Chinese government hacked into the system there. They hacked into the computer system in the Dalai Lama's offices, and I won't go into how he managed to do that. And the reason they did that was because there was a lot of communication that was going on between that office and the Tibetan resistance movement in Tibet. You know, the Chinese have been in control in Tibet. So they got the email addresses of a whole lot of people in Tibet who were imprisoned or killed as a result of that. So that's the downside of all this, for what it's worth. Something serious going on here. Okay, Ethics for the New Millennium, that aside. Dalai Lama is very focused on the fact that there are implications for the different religions of the world not getting along together, violence being one of them. Now, I've often said in class that it's not so much that there's violence between different religions and religious practitioners because of religions, but it's because of the attitudes of religious practitioners. And the last essay that we're going to read here, which is, the third essay we'll look at here, Toward a True Kinship of Faiths, Dalai Lama talks about the problem of fundamentalism, and that's what this is a problem of fundamentalism. So we'll get to that. But because he's traveled all over the world and he's met many religious leaders and many religious practitioners, he has a very distinct view of how religions might get along, the problems with religions not getting along, and different religious practitioners having different kind of attitudes. So there's a flow through these four articles, and the sequence that is on the website or the syllabus for this class is a sequence in which you should read them. And you should read them. So you start out with the selection from Ethics for a New Millennium on the role of religion in modern society, then move on to religious harmony, then move on to the chapter out of the book Toward a True Kinship of Faiths. The chapter is called The Problem of Exclusivism. And finally, we'll do Science at the Crossroads, which is this talk that he gave at the Society for Neuroscience in 2005. And that will be our segue into the rest of the class, where we start talking about psychology. He's just zooming by. So let me try and guide you into this first article.
You want me to do it?
Yeah, I thought he was just going to take off. Then he was zooming by, but he's going to mow the lawn out there. It's going to be a problem for all of us. So in the very beginning, which turns out to be on page 219 in the text, in the first paragraph, he writes, "When we think carefully, we find that conflict in the name of religion arises from two principal sources. There is that which arises simply as a result of religious diversity, the doctrinal, cultural, and practical differences between one religion and another. Then there is the conflict that arises in the context of political, economic, and other factors, mainly at the institutional level." How many people do you know say, "I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious"? Right. What is that about? That's about organized religion as a problem, but internal spiritual life, internal religiosity is necessary, desirable, attractive. I like it. Americans are very good at drawing a distinction between institutional religion and inner life. I mean, it's actually in our heritage, if you think about it. You know, if you think about the Western attitude toward just about anything, post-Enlightenment attitude, that's not a surprise. Although, of course, the early English, I'll be specific, not British, the early English immigrants to North America were very oriented toward institutional religion. If you think about the Puritans, for example, they were very much into the structure of religion as a social experience, a hierarchical experience. But there's something about American individuality as it's come to be experienced in the 20th and 21st century, that we can draw a distinction between the church and religion, between institution and inner life. In a certain sense, if you look at evangelical religion, you're looking at religion that's very oriented toward inner experience. And the churches tend to be a bit fragmented, right? I mean, if you have an internal experience, if God speaks to you, then you can start your own church if you want. It happens all the time, you know. And nobody really thinks anything of it. If people are willing to come and sit and listen to you, you've got a church. Well, I guess that's not really only European, American, and Christian. I once asked, the word in Tibetan for guru or teacher is lama, L-A-M-A, just the difference between Tibetan language and Sanskrit languages, or Sanskritic languages. So I once asked a lama, how do you become a lama? He said, it's very simple. When you have students, you're a teacher. If you don't have students, you're not a teacher. You meant spiritual teacher. I mean, in that sense, it's similar. You want to be a spiritual teacher? You go out in the marketplace in Lhasa, start talking. If anybody listens and you have students who want to follow you, now you're a teacher. Now, that's irrespective of the existence of an organized church in Tibet, and the church in Tibet was extremely well organized. Okay. The Dalai Lama is drawing a distinction here between the organized church, the institutional aspects of things, and individual spirituality. Now, if you think about the significance of that distinction right off, and he's a very analytic thinker, as you'll see as you read through this material. You might not think of religious types as being analytic, certainly not Buddhists. You think of Buddhists sort of meditating in a cave someplace. He's a very analytic, systematic thinker, and you'll see this. He believes in solving problems by systematic analysis, and that's in his Buddhist tradition. where was I going with this? If you think about this distinction and you think of the major religious conflict that the United States has right now is with the Muslim world, with the Islamic world. Right? It's interesting to ask the question, is our conflict with individual Muslims or is our conflict with Muslims who are organized around specific, quote, church-like attitudes? I mean, there isn't any church in Islam, actually. But there are organized traditions, lineages, mosques with their own teachers associated with them, for example. So a big issue in a place like Pakistan, for example, is the madrasas, which are the religious schools that are associated with the different mosques. The madrasas in Pakistan are incredibly conservative, in fact, fundamentalist for the most part. Why? The madrasas in Pakistan are funded by the Saudis. The Saudis are very conservative Muslims. Right? The Saudis, the Saudi Arabians, have seen it in their interest to fund conservative Islam in Pakistan and create generations of conservative Muslims in Pakistan for political reasons. So the attitude that you find in Pakistan toward the United States, which is a big problem if you're paying attention to the news, is institutional. It's not so much what you find in Islam itself. I know this is a little hard, because we don't know much about Islam. This is not a class on Islam or comparative religion, so we're not going to look at it very deeply. But the issue is institutional and political, and intentionally so. There's a reason why this is happening. You could go to Pakistan, if you could pass for not being an American, you could go to Pakistan and you'd find that natively what many people are interested in is mystically oriented religion based on the lives, experiences, and teaching of certain saints from that part of the world. And they get together and they chant and they dance and they practice this kind of religiosity. And these people tend to be much more open-minded in the sense that they're not virulently anti-Western. You know, that's not their deal. What they care about is religious experience. In that sense, they're almost like evangelical Christians. So the Dalai Lama has actually hung out with these people, so he's aware of that. And he's drawing this distinction between problems that come out of institutional religion and problems, as he says, that arises simply as a matter of diversity and not something that's amplified by institutional religion. Okay, so we go on to the next page, having made that point, that distinction. He's going to look more at the former rather than the latter. He's going to look at the issues of diversity, and he's not going to look at the issues of institutionalism. It is perhaps worth considering the question of whether religion is really relevant in the modern world. Many people argue that it is not. Now, this is a key argument that he's going to make that unfolds the rest of what he's writing about or speaking about. Now, I have observed that religious belief is not a precondition either of ethical conduct or of happiness itself. Okay? Religious belief is not a precondition either of ethical conduct or of happiness itself. Now, in regards to the latter, there's a little fudge in here that we're going to come to. In regard to the issue of ethical conduct, though, this is the place where he's going to look for the potential for harmony of world religions and harmony amongst the believers in different faiths, and this is the key thing. I have also suggested that whether a person practices religion or not, because he wants to, when he says this, he wants to point out that atheists are important. In fact, when he was doing his talk in New York this weekend, he said, I talk a lot about secular ethics, and he uses the word secular in the way it's used in India, which is to say respect for all religions, including atheists, because as he says, in ancient India, there were six main schools of philosophical thought that were respected by the Indians, one of which is what we call atheism. So ancient Indians respected atheists because they had an argument for why they were not religious. So he says we also have to include atheism in the process of secular ethics and respecting all religious views. Respect the people who don't have religious views. I think that's kind of a surprising statement from a major religious leader. I've also suggested that whether a person practices religion or not, the spiritual qualities of love, compassion, patience, tolerance, forgiveness, humility, and so on, that's quite a list in itself, are indispensable for human happiness. They are ethical conduct, which leads to human happiness. At the same time, I should make it clear that I believe that these are most easily and effectively developed within the context of religious practice. So it's a matter of practicality. Religion is a matter of practicality from the point of view of developing ethics and human happiness. It's not the only way to do it, though. You can be an atheist and be ethical. I also believe that when an individual sincerely practices religion, that individual will benefit enormously. People who have developed a firm faith grounded in understanding, this is important, grounded in understanding and rooted in daily practice, are in general much better at coping with adversity than those who are not. Again, it's a practical matter, he's saying. I am convinced, therefore, that religion has enormous potential to benefit humanity. Properly employed, it is an extremely effective instrument for establishing human happiness. In particular, it can play a leading role in encouraging people to develop a sense of responsibility towards others and of the need to be ethically disciplined. On these grounds, therefore, I believe that religion is still relevant today. So his argument, to recap this, his argument is not so much that religion is true, like this religion is true or that religion is true, and therefore it's important, which would probably be my argument, but that's not his argument. But rather that what is important in the world is that people need to learn how to get along. And in order for people to get along, they have to have a sense of ethical responsibility and concern for each other. That the type of relationship that people have with each other has to be grounded in certain kinds of values. Otherwise, everything falls apart. You know, I mean, if everybody decides that red lights don't mean anything anymore, and only green lights mean something, you know what's going to happen on the streets. Chaos, mayhem, destruction of life, limb, and property. Okay? So he's saying that all the stuff that we refer to as ethical is what makes societies work, and that ethics are really important in the modern world, because in the modern world we have this incredible diversity of religions, and that at the level of ultimates, these religions don't agree with each other, But at the level of what he calls secular ethics, which is the need for people to get along with each other, Ten Commandments type of stuff, which he says you can find in most religions, we have a need for cultivating those kinds of ethics to make the world work, to make everyone's life successful and happy, to use his language again. Okay, so that's why this kind of thing is important. So then he's going to go on to talk about why we need to have a certain attitude toward religious diversity in order to make the ethical side of things work. But it's the ethical side of things that matters at the global level. Not the metaphysics of a religion, not experiencing God, not whether one religion is true and the others are false, or they're all true or all of them are false, which are the number of possibilities that I can think of. What matters is how are we getting along with each other, and that's what's going to make the world work. So that's what we need to look at, and that's what he's going to focus on. Okay? So that's where I'm going to come back to tomorrow, because I'm fading out. Okay?